From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Hanoi changes tack on anti-China protests. China's summit opportunity for Moscow and Beijing. A landslide vote in India raises expectations for change. These stories and more on this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Protests against China's deployment of an oil rig in waters claimed by Vietnam were shut down by police Sunday. The move follows a week of tolerated demonstrations in Vietnam, some of which turned violent. Marianne Brown has more from the capital.
There was heavy police presence outside the Chinese embassy in Hanoi Sunday morning, and a park used by protesters last week was fenced off. The few demonstrators who turned up were quickly surrounded by police, who tried to prevent them from speaking to reporters. Lei Tian Nian, a regular participant in anti-China protests, was one of them. He said several of his friends wanted to join the protest Sunday morning, but were prevented from leaving their homes by police. Several protesters were detained by police in Ho Chi Minh City. In Hanoi, a 22-year-old protester was shoved by plainclothes police while speaking to VOA until they eventually dragged him and his friend away. One policewoman said gatherings were illegal in the area. It's a dramatic turnaround for the government, which just last week allowed large protests across the country. However, during the week, riots linked to the protests broke out in industrial zones in south and central Vietnam, with two Chinese workers killed and around 100 others injured. Some observers have speculated that the riots gathered momentum because of poor factory conditions rather than anti-China sentiment. At a Saturday news conference on the riots, officials attempted to reassure investors. Officials said the situation was now under control and companies affected would be compensated for their losses. Lieutenant General Huang Com Tu, chief of the Ministry of Public Security's Investigation Department, told reporters that hundreds of people had been arrested. The Ministry of Public Security has been criticized for acting too slowly, but Tu said the government's response had been timely. It had reacted in a proactive and drastic manner to mitigate losses, he said. The dispute over the oil rig shows no sign of abating. Vietnam said China has increased the number of vessels in the area to 130, including four Navy ships. The official Chinese news agency, Xinhua, has reported that China evacuated more than 3,000 citizens from Vietnam following the riots. Saturday, Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Zuc sent a series of text messages to subscribers of state-run mobile phone networks, calling for people to show their patriotism but not to get involved in illegal protests. The first of such messages were sent Thursday. What exactly constitutes an illegal protest remains unclear. However, the message sent by police actions Sunday suggests the government will not allow more anti-China protests anytime soon. Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Still to come on Daybreak Asia, a Korean election 60 years ago that still has a profound effect on the peninsula. The leaders of China and Russia will meet this week on the sidelines of an Asian regional summit in Shanghai. More than 40 countries and organizations are expected to attend the event, which will focus on regional security and development. VOA's Bill Ide has more from Beijing.
Ties between Moscow and Beijing have strengthened since President Xi Jinping took office. When Russian President Vladimir Putin and Mr. Xi meet this week in Shanghai, there is expectation a 30-year deal for natural gas could be signed and the two could advance cooperation in other areas. As Russia faces scrutiny over Ukraine, its economic ties with Europe are strained and its economy slows, Moscow is looking to China, says political scientist Zhang Lihua.
Russia needs Chinese investment more than ever, especially in its far eastern region. It also needs China's economic and trade support. Economic ties could expand rapidly in the coming years, not only for natural gas, but also in infrastructure and transportation, manufacturing, and other fields.
China and Russia share similar views on many international issues. But the situation in Ukraine has tested Beijing's long-standing opposition to foreign intervention. Zhang Lihua says that while the two leaders will discuss Ukraine, it is unlikely to be a major issue.
The most important message Russia and China want to send to the world is that their ties are extremely close now, and that trend will continue. But as it does, they will not seek to form a military alliance that targets any third country.
In addition to Russia, leaders from Iran, Pakistan, and more than 10 other countries will attend the two-day meetings in Shanghai. Leaders from Japan and the United States will not attend, but will send observers. China's Vice Foreign Minister Cheng Guoping says this is not meant to exclude any country.
We hope that when the United States and Japan participate in the summit, they will play the role of responsible countries.
Pakistan's president, Mamnoon Hussein, tells Chinese broadcaster CCTV that terrorism will be a key topic at the meetings.
Recently, we have seen untraditional challenges coming up in Asia as well as in all of the world. Asia is basically facing the challenges of these terrorism and extremism. I think SICA is going to concentrate to provide assistance of member countries to eradicate these three with terrorism, extremism, and separatism.
Concerns about terrorism have been rising in China following several violent attacks, two of which have been blamed on religious extremists. Chinese authorities have stepped up security in preparation for the summit, and a nationwide crackdown on terrorism is underway. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
If you have access to the internet, be sure to watch the video that goes with this story at voanews.com, either on your computer or on your smartphone. Well, China has astounding plans to build a 13,000-kilometer-high speed rail line to connect China and the United States, and it would require a tunnel under the Bering Strait connecting Russia and Alaska. In addition to the China to U.S. plan, Chinese media report there are others in the works, including a trans-Asian railway network connecting China with Burma, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Malaysia, and Singapore. Another plan would follow the ancient Silk Road trading route through China and through to major European cities. And there are also plans to build rail lines in Africa, including a high-speed line in oil-rich Nigeria, and yet another linking South Sudan with the Kenyan port of Mombasa. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Luis Thompson, a former railway advisor to the World Bank with extensive experience in China and throughout Africa. Melman asked him if such plans, especially the China to U.S. plan, could be accomplished.
Physically, of course it could be done. But economically and financially, I think the case would be very, very questionable.
Why do you think they have come up with this? You have dealt with people who build railroads in China. What do you think happened that all of a sudden there's this worldwide push for railroads?
Well, I think in one sense it represents justifiable Chinese pride in the accomplishments they have with the high-speed railway that they have in China. They've done an incredible job of designing and building high-speed rail very quickly in China. They're proud of it, and they should be. At the same time, I think trying to apply that same idea and that same approach to a railway from China to all the way through the Bering Straits to the United States, through Alaska and Canada, would be an entirely different proposition. In China, as you know, they have massive flows of freight, massive numbers of people, high densities, and things work financially and economically that would not work trying to get to the United States, where you can fly in a few hours and it would take 2 days by high-speed rail for passengers. So it's just a very different case.
Is there any suitable use for that other than getting from China to the United States? Is there traffic? Is there transportation needed to Siberia? Is there transportation needed to Alaska, to Canada?
No. Well, we have to distinguish here between freight and passenger. Most of the ideas that I've seen published have been for high-speed rail for passengers. High-speed rail for passengers takes massive numbers of people and relatively short distances. Otherwise, it doesn't work economically or financially. And by the way, there have been a number of articles written that suggest that even the Chinese high-speed system is not financially viable. The railway will not be able to pay back out of its own earnings the debt that they incurred to build a high-speed rail system in China. That doesn't mean it wasn't a good idea economically because of the benefits to the less developed regions in China, but it isn't financially viable. Now, if China's proposing to build these things for free and to give them to people, that would be one thing. But if they're proposing to lend people the money with which to build them, then the financial case becomes critical. And for the most part, that case does not exist for high-speed rail over very long distances without many passengers.
Out of the reports that you have read and the ideas for Chinese rail to be built worldwide that you have read, what is viable in your mind?
Well, we should keep in mind that the Chinese railway has the densest freight system and freight operations in the world. The massive amounts of freight on the Chinese railway, and they handle them with very high efficiency. They have massive flows of people, potentially massive flows of people, between very, very large cities. And in those cases, intercity rail passenger service might make sense. But when you try to transfer that model outside China or outside Japan or outside parts of Europe, you run into trouble.
Are we ever going to see any of these projects come to fruition?
Well, you certainly see high-speed rail in China coming to fruition. You see high-speed rail in a lot of other countries coming to fruition, much of Europe, possibly the United States, although that's still not entirely settled. And you certainly see very, very successful freight railways in China and in Russia and a lot of other parts of the world. The question is not that. The question is whether for the movement of freight from China to the United States it would make any sense to build a railway when you already have very good shipping. And for the movement of passengers from China to the United States, does it make any sense when today you can get on an airplane and fly from Beijing to Washington or New York easily and cheaply? So it's the economic and the financial case that I think people have to think about here.
You have done railway business in China. What do you think the overall reaction to these reports have been? A little snickering by chance by some individuals?
I have certainly seen articles by Chinese professionals who say they don't think the numbers add up.
Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Lewis Thompson, a former railway advisor to the World Bank, on reported plans by China to build massive railway projects around the world, including one that would link China with the United States. Outgoing Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has left office after his ruling Indian National Congress Party was crushed in parliamentary elections. In a brief address Saturday, Mr. Singh said all Indians must respect the verdict of voters who handed the opposition BJP a landslide victory, the biggest win by a single party in 30 years. He said India is a far stronger country than it was a decade ago. The Indian National Congress Party has led India for the past 10 years, but has been hit by a series of high-profile corruption scandals, high inflation, and lagging economic growth. India's Prime Minister-elect, Narendra Modi, was mobbed by flag-waving supporters as he arrived in New Delhi. Modi is now preparing for his 5-year term. He has been called polarizing, efficient, and autocratic, often in the same sentence. No Indian politician has generated so much attention and focus in recent years as India's next prime minister. VOA's Aru Pandey has more on the expectations surrounding Mr. Modi as he comes to power.
Like so many other members of India's lower class, housekeeper Bhagwat Singh says the country's economic boom has escaped him.
Every place is corrupt, everywhere. Without money, you can't get anything done. If a poor man wants something done, they are just sent from place to place.
Corruption, bureaucracy, and red tape have long plagued India, the world's largest democracy. But this man is promising change. With humble roots as the son of a tea vendor, Narendra Modi has risen through the ranks of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party and served as the chief minister of Gujarat for nearly 13 years. Supporters say in that time, he has transformed the Western Indian state into an economic success, powering homes, building roads, and attracting investment through high-profile summits like this one, with a results-driven approach and a no-nonsense attitude towards graft. It is this change that many, including India's business leaders, hope Mr. Modi will implement on a national level as prime minister. Rick Rousseau is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
Seeing him as prime minister, I think, would be very much welcomed in conversation with business leaders. They do want to see some sort of change, regulatory consistency, new economic reforms take place, ability to cut down on corruption.
But while much of the country remains hopeful about Mr. Modi's leadership, some are also fearful. He was accused of doing nothing to stop deadly sectarian riots that hit Gujarat in 2002. At least 1,000 people were killed, mostly Muslims. Although the Indian Supreme Court cleared the 63-year-old of involvement in the violence, many, particularly the country's 180 million Muslims, are wary of a man who was a longtime member of the hardline Hindu nationalist group Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS. Brookings Institution fellow Tanvi Madan says Indians will be watching to see if Mr. Modi focuses on growth and development and not promoting Hindu nationalism.
And if he's seen as moving away from his promises during the campaign to be the prime minister of all Indians, I think you will see these issues emerge again. But if he proves that he's going to focus on what he's promised to deliver, I think people will not necessarily set them aside, but I think they will move to the background.
With Mr. Modi's BJP winning in a landslide, expectations are certainly high. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
Our Daybreak Asia poll this past week asked, what topic would you most like Chinese President Xi Jinping and South Korean President Park Geun-hye to touch on in their recently announced upcoming summit in Seoul? Well, the results are in. And most of our audience who responded, 40.6%, chose tensions in the South China Sea, followed by more than 26% choosing nuclear threats from North Korea. Economic ties between China and South Korea was important to many, almost 18%, and the country's relationship with Japan coming in at just over 13%. Only 2% weren't sure what they should be discussing. Well, we thank all who took part, and as always, you can stop by and let us know what you think at our program page, voanews.com/daybreakasia, and on our VOA Asia Facebook page. 6 years ago this week, South Koreans went to the polls in an election that had a huge impact on the Korean Peninsula. The results of the election are still being felt today. Those elections were supposed to have been held in both the North and the South. But as VOA's Dave DeForest learned in a conversation with Columbia University Korean Studies professor Charles Armstrong, only part of the peninsula held the UN-supervised elections.
About the elections in 1948, do I understand correctly that they were held only in the South?
Yes, that's correct. The North Koreans refused to allow the UN election monitors into the North. So the elections were held only in the southern part of Korea.
Did they give a reason for that?
The North Korean and the Soviet argument that the Soviets were still occupying North Korea was that elections under current circumstances would not be free because of the suppression of the communists in South Korea, and therefore would not reflect the genuine feelings of the Korean voters, so they refused to participate in UN-monitored elections.
Now, these elections were controversial overseas and on the Korean Peninsula. What were the objections?
Well, many of the Western allies of the United States were troubled by the conditions of political freedom or lack of freedom under Syngman Rhee, who was by that time the de facto leader of South Korea, although he was not yet elected president. There had been a great deal of violence and turmoil in South Korea since liberation from Japanese colonial rule in 1945. Many political opponents of Rhee's emerging government were executed or otherwise mistreated, and there was a lot of concern in the United States, but particularly in Britain and other countries allied to the United States, that elections would not really be free or could not be monitored carefully because of the political turmoil and violence.
Did the elections, in fact, end up being free, or does it still have a cloud hanging over it?
There were certainly accusations and criticism of impropriety, elections, rigging elections, intimidation at the polling booth, and so forth. But the UN report itself, from the UN body that monitored the elections, said that the elections were reasonably free and fair in the area covered by the UN, that is to say, in South Korea.
What was the result of the election? Who won?
Syngman Rhee and his party won by 91.8%, with 91.8% of the vote. So pretty remarkable. That, of course, also raised some suspicions about the fairness of the election, but he clearly was the winner.
Did he overinterpret his mandate?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that he thought that he had an enormous mandate to do what he wanted, including unify Korea. And, you know, he believed, and certainly he said, that the Northern Communist regime should be eliminated and that the U.S. should support him in attacking the North, in a military takeover of the North. Now, some people think he was just bluffing, and certainly the U.S. wasn't about to support this kind of adventurism. But he stated publicly that his task now as the leader of the Republic of Korea was to take back the northern part of the peninsula that had been stolen by the communists.
And the northern part of the peninsula also thought they had a mandate eventually to reunify the peninsula under their rule.
Yes, exactly. 3 weeks after the Republic of Korea was formally established in August of 1948, the northern communist-dominated regime declared that their election, which was held separately from the south, which was not exactly a democratic election, but you know, there were the symbols and gestures, anyway, of a democratic process and voting, had created a different government called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea with its leader, Kim Il-sung. So by September of 1948, you had two rival governments on the Korean Peninsula, both of which claimed to govern the whole of Korea, and both of which had ideas of attacking the other, although Syngman Rhee made his plan to attack the North much more public, whereas we now know that Kim Il-sung talked about a peaceful unification but actually had been mobilizing for some time to get Soviet support to attack the South.
And in terms of the division of the peninsula, these elections set up a situation that exists to this day.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true. You know, Korea was divided temporarily in 1945, but the elections really consolidated the division between two separate governments, and the war, which broke out in June 1950, didn't resolve this division at all. In fact, the war made unification even more difficult than it might otherwise have been because neither side could ever trust the other.
Charles Armstrong is a professor of Korean studies at Columbia University in New York, and he spoke with VOA's Dave DeForest. We'd like to let you know that the latest world news is on its way. In fact, it's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really
really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.